What's up, guys? This is Uriah Faber, the California Kid, here with Greg Conley, serial entrepreneur, founder of Trifecta Nutrition. We're talking about everything under the sun, fitness, entertainment, and of course, business, making that money.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to welcome you to the CaliCast. And this is a special day. Not only is it the first cast, but it's also with a monumental person who has basically been the cornerstone to mixed martial arts in his own way, not as a mixed martial artist, but as a entrepreneur, as a person that thinks outside the box, as a guy who's not afraid to dream, which is what I'm all about, which I can appreciate. That's my boy here. Young man, young spirit. And, I mean, what an awesome guy. This is Art Davey. And so for those who don't know, mixed martial arts is a sport. UFC is a league. And there's many other leagues now. We've got Bellator. We've got 1FC. We've had, you know, a bunch of different shows from Pride, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it all started with our man here, Art Davey. And Art is not only a guy that is a man's man, you know. He's also, in what I've seen and what I've heard, kind of a perfectionist and an expert in finding things that he's passionate about and making it his lifestyle. So as a businessman, it's been 30 some odd years where he's made his own way in this world. But as a person who has brought mixed martial arts to the forefront, it's been kind of a lifetime achievement. And as you can see right now, he's wearing a ring. If you're watching this, if you're just listening, this is a mixed martial arts Hall of Fame ring. And that's because he started the brand that we know of, UFC, and it started with a bunch of different names, and it just came with one concept, which is, who is the baddest man on the planet? Who is the baddest dude in the world? And he was the first guy to say, hey, let's find it out. And I want to hear a little bit about what made Art Davey want to figure out, hey, who is the baddest dude on the planet? How do we celebrate that? How do we show the world? And who is ballsy enough to make it happen? You're talking to the man, Art Davey. So, Davey, please tell us a little bit about how this whole thing got started.
Well, you know, it began really in 1989. That was really the beginning of it. And I talk about it in my book, Is This Legal?, which is the story of the first UFC.
Is this legal?
Is this legal?
That's a great question.
And by the way, the title came from Chuck Norris. We really wanted to invite Chuck Norris as a great, you know, full contact karate fighter, TV and movie star. And we wanted him to be at the first event, you know, maybe just be cage side. We asked him maybe if he would like to be a color commentator, you know. And his reaction was, is this legal? Are you guys sure you can do this? He said, you know, I think he was worried maybe the sheriff would show up, the police, maybe the National Guard. So he never came to the party. We asked him to come to the party, but he didn't come to the party. Now, in all fairness, when I was a kid growing up, the real Mr. Universe was the world heavyweight boxing champ. I mean, you wanted to talk about a guy that established who was the big dog in, right, you know, in combat sports fighting, you'd have to say it was, you know, Muhammad Ali. And when you think about it, the Muhammad Ali's of this world made a ton of money doing this. The truth of the matter is, in the martial arts, nobody was making really any money. If you had a martial arts school, you were making a living, you were paying your rent, you were putting your kids into school, putting food on the table, but nobody was really getting rich in the martial arts. Kickboxing had a short history where it kind of took off a bit, and then it kind of faded. And if you were any good at the martial arts, Uriah, you went into the TV or the movies. And
right.
I say that, right? Because we're
who
talking,
were the guys? Who were the guys at that time?
Yeah, you're talking about your Bruce Lee, your
That's
Chuck Norris,
boy.
Right? Your
Chuck.
Your Steven Seagal.
That's it.
You know, your Jean-Claude Van Damme. If you, Jeff Speakman, Jim Kelly. If you were any good in the martial arts, you got out of the martial arts. You went over and you did something else using your reputation in the martial arts to move it forward. Now, you look at MMA today, and people credit me with the creation of the UFC. But in all fairness, I was recruiting people who were in Shotokan, karate, you know, a lot of the traditional styles.
Sumo.
Well, we decided to bring Sumo in because that was my hang-up. I wanted a professional boxer in Sumo. But, you know, at the time, when you think about the martial arts, Uriah, it was guys who were studying Taekwondo down at a strip mall, maybe did a little judo, and you know. And in all fairness, I also brought in a lot of brawlers, you know, guys like Tank Abbott.
Right.
Today, when you look at MMA, it's become submission kickboxing, very sophisticated. The level of what happened and why MMA advanced, it wasn't even us promoters. It was you guys, the fighters. You guys starting in UFC 3 started to cross-train. You guys started to say, hey, I came from a wrestling background, but now I got to learn how to, I got to kick, maybe how to punch. And yeah, you guys started to cross-train. The biggest change in the combat sports fighting space isn't what we promoters did. You know, admittedly, the octagon is still the same, the cages are still the same, the lighting is a little better, the crowd's a little bigger, but it's you fighters who changed. It's you guys who decided, maybe I came out of wrestling, I needed to learn how to kick to the legs like, you know, Muay Thai.
Yeah.
I needed to know how to jab and throw a left cross and a right hook, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at, and we're talking about fighters, what you look at when you talk about fighters is a mentality of, I'm the baddest man on the planet. And I talked about it today when I was talking about, having excuses. There's good excuses and there's bad excuses. Mm. If you're a fighter and you pride yourself on being the baddest dude on the planet, whether you're Kodokan karate or you're judo or you're wrestling, et cetera, you internally believe, hey, I'm the baddest motherfucker on the planet, period.
Yeah.
And when that is not the case, and like you saw, you know, you have guys that come in and fight, and all of a sudden they're getting tapped out because their neck's getting choked, or they're getting, you know, kicked in the leg so hard they can't stand up anymore, like Randy Couture against Rizzo.
Yep.
You know, what happens is you make an excuse. Well, I'm not the baddest man because I need to get better at this, or I need to get better at that. And that's when the evolution started.
Yes, absolutely.
And your vision was, hey, which is the best? Is it boxing? Is it wrestling? Is it judo? Is it jiu-jitsu? I mean, you're looking all over the world.
Yeah, that was the original concept, and I've been even accused of being the pioneer at basically the spectacle that we created in the beginning, which was really style versus style. But then again, if you didn't come from a kempo or taekwondo or karate, or you were a bob roller, you maybe did some wrestling, in a sense, what has happened is there's been an evolution, and the fighters today have created a modern sport, which I gave birth to, but they evolved and allowed it to become what it is today. And in all fairness, I think one of the best contributions that I had was I was always very clear about the fact that I was trying to find the baddest mother on the planet.
Yeah.
I was very oriented toward the entertainment aspects. See, you know, if you had had some black belt in karate start what I did, it would have gone in the purest direction. It never would have become big. It would have, it'd probably be gone. My advantage is that I wasn't a black belt in any particular martial art. I was an advertising guy. I'm always looking at the product and the customer. Whether you make an earth shoe, a widget, whatever you're looking for a customer and you want to be able to get that customer excited about your product. So for me to look at combat sports entertainment, and that's, again, combat sports entertainment, I said to myself, what I've got to do is to recruit, and I decided to do that, to be able to do it with a tournament. I could do a single elimination tournament, recruit 8 fighters, 7 bouts. You'd have to beat 3 men in one guy in one night, one pay-per-view broadcast. So my orientation towards entertainment was a big deal in the very beginning. I wanted to find the best, the baddest guy on the planet. Now, the martial arts purists would have said, well, we've got to find, you know, the best, the guy, you know, he's a great guy at kata, and he's mastered all the techniques that the great, you know, Asian guru had taught him, and we're honoring him by doing this. That wasn't my task at all. I wanted to find the baddest mother on the planet.
And make some money at that.
Absolutely, because that's the other key piece.
Right.
The boxing guys had shown that they knew how to make money with a combat sport. The wrestling people, the Vince McMahons of this world, the Eric Bischoffs of this world, they knew how to make money with that kind of combat entertainment. And the martial arts was like a desert. It was like the you know, there was nothing going on there. If you did anything in the martial arts, you had 100 maybe students calling you master, and that was pretty cool, and you didn't want to fight the guy across town because if it was done publicly, you could be embarrassed. You'd lose your students. But I had this picture. Wait a minute. We're going to find the great white shark, the apex predator, baby. We're going to find the baddest man on the planet. And, you know, early on in looking and researching, I was able to hook up with the Gracies. The advantage of hooking up with the Gracies was this. They had a tradition in Brazil where they were willing to challenge other martial arts artists. So I thought that was an enormous advantage, because a lot of people that I would get on the phone with and say, hey, I'm thinking about doing this thing. Would you be party to it? Would you come to the party if I call? Oh, well, you know, is this a movie you're going to do? You're looking for? I said, no, I'm not casting for a movie, baby. I'm looking for the toughest man on the planet. Oh, that's been talked about. That belong in the movies. That's in the video games, right? Mortal Kombat, Street Fighter. I had a clear picture of what I wanted to do was to put out the call to everybody in the world. Taekwondo guys, Muay Thai guys, Savate guys, you know, Kendo, Bando, Kenpo, Karate,
Wrestling, Shingi, Jiu-Jitsu.
Wrestling, Jiu-Jitsu. And I was crazy enough to say, I'm even going to put a sumo wrestler in the first event and a professional boxer.
Who lost his teeth, by the way, because I watched that. I was in high school, barely in high school, and I watched teeth fly across the octagon, which excited me and made me, who didn't understand that I was quite full grown at the time.
You were 14 and full grown at the time.
Yeah,
right.
13 or 14. Yeah. You know.
Was that the first UFC you saw, Uriah?
I saw number one.
You did.
I saw number one. I saw number two. I saw number three. Wow. I mean, for me, UFC at the time was like my Super Bowl. It was, you know, I'd watch it over and over again. I watched it on slow mo, and for me, I was like, okay, this is something that I want to do.
Did you think maybe from the advertising that it might have been like a wrestling thing? Might have been doing the work, you know, of some type. Or were you clear that it was going to be some kind of a real martial arts contest to find the bad dude?
No, I knew what the deal was.
You
I
did?
Mean, you know, I had a buddy. His name is Damian Bromrick, and his family would always get the fights, and we'd go over and watch. He was a wrestling buddy of mine, and it was about like, hey, who's the baddest man?
Yeah.
And I was a little disappointed at times because guys would break their hands and do this and do that. So I was happy to see the sport progress. But for me, it was the ultimate spectacle and something that I wanted to do, believed I could do well in,
right,
which is the only way you can compete in our sport, is to really, really believe. And, you know, that was the key. And, you know, I've had a chance. We're out here actually visiting a bunch of troops,
right?
You're kind of telling your story, and this podcast here is about mixed martial arts, but it's also about business,
and
it's about entertainment,
right?
Which is something that you're not only a guru in when it comes to the business, but also learning a lot as a entertainer.
Yes.
So, I want to talk about that a little bit, because one of my new passions as a retired fighter is learning the entertainment business, and I've learned a lot. One of the biggest things that stood out to me, which no one else in the room caught when you gave your presentation, was about a director that you attached to the project of the UFC.
Mm-hmm.
And what's his name?
Mark Lucas.
Mark Lucas. And then Milius.
And John Milius.
And John Milius. So
Mark Lucas had worked the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta. So he understood above and beyond how to do a concert on pay-per-view. And by the way, the two original ideas I had was that A, should be a tournament. B, it needed to be on pay-per-view. Because as I mentioned earlier here in this podcast, Uriah, the boxing guys knew how to make money with combat sports. The martial arts guys didn't. The wrestlers did, professional. I had to figure a way to make money with this. I figured I needed a great live event. I'd sell 5,000 to 6,000 tickets. That's cool. But the pay-per-view thing allowed me to turn everybody's couch in their home into a paid seat.
Yes.
And so that was very important to me. And early on, I understood we were in the entertainment business, that we needed to have a great TV partner that understood how to produce and project this thing, so that when people saw it at home, they go, what the fuck is this? This ain't your father's Oldsmobile, baby. This is something else.
That's right.
And I got to tell you, the fact of the matter is, early on I was able, through the Gracies, to meet John Milius.
Right.
John Milius was a student of the Gracies. I had a private class with Horry on 8 o'clock on a Tuesday night. The guy who had a private class right after me was John Milius. And I had spotted him at one of the improv mixed matches that the Gracies were doing in their back room. There was no $100,000 Gracie challenge. Ain't nobody had $100,000. Again, none of them martial artists had no fucking money. But one day I'm standing back there, and I look over next to me, and there's this big guy with a beard, And I recognized him from somewhere. I said, I see this dude on TV somewhere, but I didn't know who he was. I asked Horian, and Horian said, hey, that's John Milius. I said, John Milius, who produced Conan the Barbarian and made Arnold Schwarzenegger a star, who won an Academy Award nomination for Apocalypse Now? He said, that's the guy. He's been taking class for a year and a half. So I early on cultivated John, and I found out that John, who had asthma, wanted to go in the Marines during the 60s, and couldn't get in because of the asthma.
Right.
But he found out that I had enlisted in the Marines in 66 successfully, served the tour of duty in Vietnam. So that kind of bonded John and I. And John one day found me smoking a Jamaican cigar, or I had it in my pocket. And he said to me, what's that? I said, well, you know, it's a nice cigar. He said, no, no. He said, well, show me what it is. And I showed him. He says, there's two kinds of cigars. There's Cubans and there's rope. And that's what you're smoking. So he took me out to his car. He had a humidor in the trunk of the car, and he gave me some Cuban cigars. So John and I bonded early on, and John allowed us to attach his name to the project as creative director.
Right.
That enabled me, again, going back to making money with this thing, and again, entertainment, I realized I couldn't put this on broadcast. Ain't no CBS, NBC, ABC gonna put this stuff on. And cable would have said, well, wait a minute. It's not a cooking show, or it's right. not, you know, what the, you can't do this here. But pay-per-view was big for boxing and wrestling, and it was like renting someone's home and selling them a seat for $20 right in their house.
Yeah.
So early on, I got John to allow me to attach his name to the project, because then when I went to the HBOs and the Showtimes of this world, I could say, well, you know, John Milius is going to be our creative director. And they would look at me and
that's
go,
instant clout.
He was like, really?
And this is funny. Yeah. I mean, for the people who are watching or listening at home, John Milius to me was no one until I met a guy named Mickey Rourke. Is a massive mixed martial arts fan. He's good friends with myself.
He did professional boxing.
And Michael Bisping. He also took a hiatus from the acting world
yes.
to become a professional boxer
yes.
and a good boxer at
Pretty
that.
Pretty good, yeah.
And he told me years later, when I was talking to him, because I'm telling him, I want to get into movies, I want to get into producing, I want to get into this entertainment business.
Right.
He said, listen, this is the guy you need to check out. You need to check out John Milius. He's a fucking guru.
He's a
savage. He's a wild man. He's had a stroke. He's a different guy now. Yeah. But like the films he was doing,
yes.
that's the man's man. That's the stuff that we're all about. And Mickey's a real man's man. He likes to fight. He likes to,
yes.
you know, he is what it is, right? So when I see Art Davey doing his presentation out here, we're doing a military-based presentation, and he's got John Milius on the scoreboards.
Right.
I'm thinking, this guy's got John Milius backing him, and it starts a whole other conversation. So, you know, it's an interesting conversation for Art to tell me about how he actually created out of his vision, out of his you know, core of a man as a businessman and as a spectator. The UFC, and then to understand that he's got relationships with guys like Lucas and guys like Milius and Peter Guber, who's one of
yes.
the biggest producers of all times, did The Color Purple, and he did The Rain Man, and he did
Flash Dance.
Flash Dance. He yeah. did some of the most iconic movies of all time.
He was CEO
yeah.
of Sony.
And it's so crazy how UFC, entertainment, business are all so closely related,
yes.
and it hits home for me because I'm a fan of all. Trying to be a master of all. I've mastered one, mixed martial arts,
right.
become a world champion.
Yep.
But now I'm learning more about business, more about entertainment. And this guy, who started it all with the same vision, is kind of a reinvention of what I'm all about. So I love talking to you. And tell us a little bit about how you found out about jiu-jitsu and how you attached yourself to it, and mm-hmm. then how you recruited the talent for the first UFC and what that looked like.
You know, in doing some homework on this raw idea that I had, and I tell the story that, you know, when I was 18, I got my butt kicked by a wrestler. And I never forgot that. I was training for the Golden Gloves at the time. I thought I was, you know, kind of a semi-badass. And a wrestler embarrassed me and put me on the ground and made me tap out. So in doing my research, I began to try to find out who out there was actually had ever done a mixed match. I found out that most of these things never took place because they'd argue about the money and the rules. And in the course of my homework down at the library, because there wasn't much of internet in those days,
yeah.
you know, at Al Gore.
What year was this?
This is basically, we're now talking about 1989.
Wow.
you know, and there was really no internet at that point. So in looking in these various articles in the reference section of the library, I'm reading about this family that had emigrated from Brazil, and they're called the Gracies. It was in a September 1989 issue of Playboy. The article was titled BAD by Pat Jordan, a well-known sports writer in the Florida area. And she talked about that these Gracies had this $100,000 challenge, you know, that they would put up $100,000, you put up $100,000, and the Gracies were willing to fight you to see who was the best. Again, style versus style. Now, remember that most of the people at the time in the martial arts weren't willing to do style versus style. It would cost them students.
Yeah, from a business standpoint, and you talked about this, which I loved, was if you have two karate dojos in the same town, and the karate dojo masters fought each other.
Right. Somebody's going to lose business.
Somebody's going to lose, and somebody's going to lose business. That's money. That's that's cash. That's clout. That's a lot of different things.
Uriah also found, too, and in fact, this was a point of agreement between Jorge and Gracie and I. We felt that there were a lot of charlatans out there, a lot of frauds. There were people advertising in the magazines that they knew the Shaolin monk death touch, you know.
Yeah, George the dim mock.
The dim mock.
You touch you, I touch you, you die.
You die 6 months later. George Dillman was doing this pressure point seminar where he would kind of knock people out in these seminars. It was virtually hypnosis, you know, and making people think that they had been fucked up that way. So we found a lot of charlatans out there, a lot of people advertising in the magazine saying, I'm the bad dude. So the beauty of what we were doing by creating this octagon, again, we didn't want to do a boxing ring. It ain't boxing. We needed to make it look different. So the octagon became a crucible, a place where we could boil out the elements of who was real and who was fucking false, who was an asshole and who was the real deal. And suddenly we could find the real bad dude on the planet, the great white shark, the apex predator. And early on, I realized that with the Gracies, that the advantage that I had is they were willing to do it. And I took some lessons. I got myself a blue belt. I met John McCarthy that way, the UFC referee. And as we moved forward to create that first event, I was able to get us a TV partner, got turned down by a lot of the big boys, but finally found a company well-funded by a big outfit in Europe who were willing to put up the money. And we went out and, again, I created a great business plan, 65-page. I talked about the fact that I felt like I was Carl Denham, the promoter, the producer in the movie King Kong. And when they knocked out King Kong and he's laying on the beach, all the staff and the crew from the ship are saying, man, we got to get away from this. Thank God we at least knocked him out with the gas bombs. And Carl Denham says to them, boys, this is Kong, the eighth wonder of the world. You're all going to be rich. He'll be on Broadway in lights. And that's how I saw the UFC. I saw this event as a tournament with at least a $50,000 first prize, growing all the time, maybe eventually $1 million, looking for whether it was a 6 foot, 11 inch guy from China or a wrestler from the University of Iowa that Dan Gable would have given me, or a professional boxer from St. Louis. I didn't care. I said, we're going to find the right guy. Now, the Gracies were really into this, in all fairness, Uriah, because for them it was a means to an
end. Yeah, it was, and like you said already, you had earned clout. Something that he hasn't talked about yet, but we'll talk about now is, you know,
I was a businessman.
Art was a businessman, and he earned clout with the Gracies, who were purists of mixed martial arts, by making them some cash.
Yeah,
that's a key thing, because it's one thing to come in and talk. It's another thing to show action. As a businessman, I know that myself.
Right.
You know, when you can provide dollars for someone, you all of a sudden have their attention.
And you got credibility, but you got their
attention. And you did that.
Yeah. You know, the funny story was is that the Gracies had never made this $100,000 challenge work. People would argue about the rules and the money.
Right.
Never
did they have the $100,000?
No, they didn't.
Yeah.
See, I actually asked them at one point, you got $100,000? You got $10,000? He didn't have it. And nobody else, including Benny the Jet Urquidez, had one time, you know, Horian called him up. I think they met at a seminar. And Benny said, I ain't putting up the $100,000. I don't know if Benny had the $100,000.
Yeah.
He said, I'll give you my belts if you win. And Horian said, I don't need your belts. I got my own belt. So the fact of the matter is that they were willing to do this. And I think that was a big plus for me, because I then had somebody that I could build on. I knew if I could get...
You knew for sure
yes.
You had a person that would challenge anyone right. you put up there.
On the other hand, yeah. as you were asking me about, in the beginning, I didn't have any credibility with him. I was just another guy, an ad guy, a salesman in a suit, taking lessons. And Horian at that point had been approached by everybody and his uncle saying, hey, man, we know how to make you $1 million with this Gracie Challenge thing. And Horian, I guess, had been turned off by so many of these guys that he was not cool with it. He was not right. cool with being pitched and approached. What I decided to do, being working in an advertising agency as I was at the time, I knew how to do direct mail. So to make a long story short, I said, I'm going to do a free direct mail campaign for you. I sell this to clients for 10, 12 grand. I'm going to do it for you for free. Just pay the printing and the postage. And I talked Horian into doing it. It brought in $150,000 cash in the mail in 6 weeks.
Wow.
Now, when that...
6 weeks.
6 weeks, baby.
And what year was this?
This is 1991.
Holy shit.
And now...
That's a lot of money.
A lot of money.
Now, that's even more money in 1991.
Absolutely. And he, you know, like, he was making a living. They had done the new leasehold improvements on this first school that they really, because he had been teaching in his garage before he met me. And now he's got this school and he's got to pay for the overhead and he's got his brothers working there. And the bottom line was, by doing that direct mail campaign and getting him $150,000, now when I walked in his office, he said, what are we going to do next?
Yeah.
I said, Davey, we're
going to... He was ready to play ball.
He was ready to play ball. And I said, we're going to do the world's best fighter. I outlined my big idea. I wanted to do a tournament, and I wanted to put it on pay-per-view. Horian said, I never heard about this direct mail, but that works. He said, pay-per-view, I don't know much about it. I said, well, that's what wrestling and boxing is. So I said, we're going to form a corporation. And I found out that maybe we can do this in Colorado because they had no restrictions on bare-knuckle fighting. There was a cool corporate structure up there called LLC. The gas and the oil drillers.
Limited liability company, for those who don't know, that's all over the world now.
Yeah, and at the time, Uriah, there was only 3 states in America that had the LLC form. A lot of your gas and oil drillers, the people drilling for new oil, you know, if that rig blew up and you were sued for $1 million, your investor, if he only put in $10,000, he was only liable then for the $10,000. So I said to Horian, we're going to do all this. I went up to Denver. I got us a lawyer. I got us a bank account. I got us an accountant. And I began to reach out to television. And again, I tell the story that I was turned down by HBO. I was turned down by Showtime. But I located Semaphore Entertainment. They had been doing concerts and comedy. Make a long story short, we wound up doing a deal with them. So now we got the money to basically sit at a table and talk to anybody in television. We raised several hundred thousand dollars from our investors. We went and did a pitch using my business plan, and we pitched it to family and friends. 28 people, 21 of them who were students of the Gracie Jiu-Jitsu Academy, the rest were personal friends of mine, had given us the money to be put on our big boy pants and sit down and do a little business. So at that point, we were now ready to rock and roll. Once I was able to put a TV deal together, we could then talk about, hey, do we do this thing in Brazil? And we wound up talking to Lulu da Silva, who's a great rock and roll and music producer and live event promoter in Rio de Janeiro. His father is the guy who designed the United Nations building as an architect in New York City. Very famous in Brazil. And he told us, you know, you want to do this in Brazil, it's going to be very costly. He said, Brazilians are going to sneak over the fence. You're going to sell 5,000 tickets, and it'll be 5,000 Brazilians under the fence. He said, I do a lot of my work now in Argentina. So I pressured Horian then to say, we're going to do this in Denver. Because we can do it there. We got the bare-knuckle fighting clearance there. We got a corporation up there. And that allowed us to be able to move forward on this thing and be able to do the first event. And now the big thing was trying to get fighters.
Right.
I said to Horian, pick up fighters.
Before we get in the fighter side,
yeah.
As a businessman, the coolest thing that I just saw was a vision, a plan.
Yes.
65 pages of a plan.
Yep.
Of the business plan.
Yep.
And then a sales pitch.
Yes.
Right. And that sales pitch, which you're great at and which was your specialty, was convincing people of your vision and
yes.
showing them the plan and showing them how. Because I have people ask me all the time as a business guy, hey, how do I do it? I don't have any money.
Right.
Show people how you can make them money.
Yes.
Make them money.
Yes.
Be legitimate about it.
Yep.
Make it real.
Yep.
Pitch it. Sell it.
Yep.
And then, if you want to do more business,
right.
you actually make it happen.
Yep.
Make somebody money. That's how you get more business.
Absolutely.
That's how you get more investors, et cetera, et cetera. So
that's the key.
You were able to have a passionate pitch, create a great game plan,
yep.
then go out and sell it.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what provided me with a job,
mm.
with Randy Couture with a job, with all these other people
yep.
in the whole world the job, a sale of $4.something billion
last year
that Dana White and Lorenzo Fertitta put together.
Right.
It all started from a crazy idea, a sales pitch, a business plan, and some follow through. So let's talk about how you got some of these fighters to commit, because we all know, as men and women these days as well,
right.
somebody thinks they're the baddest person on the planet. Yep. How did you find these people, and how did you incentivize and convince them to step up and prove it?
You know, that's really the key. And you, as a Hall of Fame fighter, know that the guys that you're looking for, or if you do women, the women you're looking for, you've got to find the ones that want to prove something. I wasn't going to be looking for the people that I knew would be worried if they lost, they'd lose their business. I needed to find those eagles who said, I'll show you how high I can fly. Just put them in front of me. I'm a meat eater. So I had to find people who wanted to prove something. And that started to get easier in a way, because I was sending faxes in those days to martial arts organizations all over the damn planet. We put ads in all the martial arts magazines saying, hey, come to the party. We're going to do it. And early on, Uriah, we talked about maybe it was going to be on Halloween, 1993, October 31st. And I began to reach out to people who I decided, after I interviewed them, that they had something to prove. Kevin Rozier had held 3 kickboxing titles, but he never felt he had earned respect from the martial arts fans. He said to me, I want to do this because I want to show people that I always was the real deal. Gerard Gourdeau in Europe that I brought in from the Chakariki gym in Amsterdam, he said, a lot of people know me for what I do, and I've been threatening and being a tough guy in my city for a long time. He said, I got no problem doing this internationally. I've done it in Bangkok and Tokyo. He said, I'll do it in Denver. So that was early on part of my answer, was to find the eagles, to find the lions. Because I knew that, by the way, I got turned down by every rabbit and every mouse that I called. Well, is this a movie, man? You were looking scared. Yeah, they were scared, man. And I figured, as soon as that was, I hung up the phone on a lot of them guys, too. I said, this guy ain't never going to do it. He's a pussy. What I needed to find was the eagles and the lions. And I found people out there that had something to prove. I found people, and that was a big part of it. So I was able finally to recruit the 8 men. Horian Gracie put up his brother Hoyce. I found a professional boxer who was 29-5 at the time, who was planning to fight Tommy Hitman Hearns 6-8 weeks after our first event, Hall of Famer himself. I found Ken Wayne Shamrock, who had done tough man boxing in America, wrestling, and doing shoot fighting over in Japan with Pancrase. And he said, nobody you can put me up against that I can't kill, I can't destroy. He said, in fact, and I'd given him an indication of who I'd already recruited. He said, I'll kill that dude. I'll kill that ass. He said, I'll eat him. I eat people like that for breakfast. So when I was starting to get that kind of response, I said to myself, you know something? I'm going to get the 8. And then I needed 2 alternates in case there was injuries. I dedicated my book, Is This Legal?, about the first UFC to those 10 fighters. Because those were 10 guys, God bless them, who had the guts to step up and put their reputations on the line. The rabbits and the mice stayed home. Absolutely. I got the lions and some eagles. I give them a full blessing on that.
And there's kinship there. I mean, I can feel the camaraderie just from what those guys believed in themselves.
Yeah.
But also what you talked about, which I can identify with, is how important it was for you to find entertainers on top of it. So when you saw a name, Shamrock, Ken Shamrock, you said, now that's a name. You know, when you looked for your sumo, he was from Hawaii.
Right.
But you wanted him to be a little more authentic. So we came to a compromise of names.
On his name, yeah, right.
Of names.
More Samoan.
Yeah, a little more Samoan,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And made a contrast. So that key of what we see today of, you know, finding the stars and building them into stars.
Conor McGregor is a good example.
McGregor is a great example.
Yeah.
It started with this guy understanding business, understanding entertainment.
Yes.
And understanding that, you know, fighting's great, but you have to have personality.
Absolutely.
A storyline. You have to have intrigue.
Yep.
And that's one of the coolest things that has started from the very beginning and continued on to this level now and gone, you know, above and beyond. So, I mean, from those stories, I feel like, you know, some of the funniest stories, I mean, one of the things that you talked about was Shamrock not understanding whether or not this was a fixed deal or was this a real deal.
Yeah. You know, and
you got to give him credit for the fact that, either way he was in.
Absolutely.
Right.
Either way he wanted to prove what he wanted to prove.
So how did that work anyways? You talked about there's a shoot.
Yeah. As a promoter, early on I began doing my homework to understand that in the fight business, basically you had shoots. And a shoot is where both fighters bring the full game to the party. They want to see who's the best. They're there to win or kill, period. A work is a prearranged match. It's choreographed. One guy's going to win. They've worked that out beforehand in the dressing room. The promoter's blessed it. Wrestling is done that way. Professional wrestling.
WWE,
WWE, the NWA, et cetera. A partial work is where only one guy is in on it. And, you know, supposedly, Sonny Liston versus Cassius Clay in 1964 in Miami Beach was supposedly a partial work that the mob or the organized crime influences had basically decided to pay off Sonny Liston and allow Cassius Clay, who they felt was going to become very popular, who obviously did. So that would be a partial work. So early on in recruiting Ken Shamrock, and as you pointed out, I was looking for a certain amount of charisma. I had a criteria. You had to be able to fight. I had to have a guy who could really fight. I needed a lion or an eagle who wasn't afraid to fight. And as you know, so many fighters leave their fights in the gym. So many fighters come to a pro match, a pro bout. They've already decided to lose. They're already going to tell you that they're going to lose in so many ways. And later on, they'll tell you, they screwed up my entrance music. I got a cough that morning. They got excuses. So I was early on always in my interviews trying to figure a guy who was already prepared to lose, and he would somehow reveal it to me when I would probe. I was pretty good with people, and I felt in talking to people, and basically as a salesman in advertising, that guys would tell me what I needed to hear. So early on, that was a big deal for me, was to get into a guy's head and for me to understand a couple of things. Did he have charisma? Did he have an ability to project himself? Was there a personality there? Was it going to be something that the audience would identify with as a winner or a loser? And if he himself was prepared to lose, quite frankly, and I like him as a person, Zane Fraser told me, despite the fact that when I first met him, he had supposedly in a brawl beaten up Frank Dukes, the legendary ninja, and I was there
From Bloodsport.
From Bloodsport, right?
The character that Bloodsport was supposedly
based
made
on,
after, but
yes,
supposedly also,
yes,
was a hoax.
Yes.
Unfortunately.
And yet Zane Fraser, when I first met him, started to tell me about a karate tournament he was in, that his asthma affected him at height and whatever city they were in, and that he basically lost. And I thought to myself, there's some quality about this guy that tells me that he is prepared to lose and he's looking for excuses even early on before the first bout. So some guys leave their fight in the gym, and you know that as a pro and a Hall of Famer. But early on, I got pretty good at doing that. And yet, I want to tell you that I made mistakes. Part of my brilliant idea about doing a tournament by UFC 3 started to show the flaw. The flaw was a great fighter could break his hand in the second round, never make it to the finals. The injuries eventually doomed, as it did, not only for the UFC, but for Bjorn Rebny over at Bellator, doomed the tournament concept. But the beauty of the tournament concept when launching it was that it allowed us to reach out to fans in a way that grabbed them by the throat. Our pay-per-view numbers on the first event proved that there was an audience out there waiting for this idea that I had come up with. They were avid for it. They were hungry for it. Feed me. When are you going to do the next one? When are you coming back? And when we came back on UFC 2, Uriah.
So what were the pay-per-view numbers on number one, first off?
87,000.
87,000.
Yeah.
Which is pretty incredible for a brand new event.
And it was only 33 million homes at the time wired for pay-per-view. Today it's 100 million. So that was a big number. Our TV partner in New York, who had done this joint venture deal with us, they felt that we might only do 40,000. They said, boy, if we do 50, it would be like Christmas and Hanukkah's come early. Truth of the matter was, they were probably thinking we were going to do 25. When we did almost 88,000 the first event, and we did 300,000 on UFC 2.
Wow.
Man, as I told you, at one point I get a call from Eric Bischoff in the wrestling world who says, who the fuck are you guys? Where'd you come from? I never heard of you before. We shocked everybody. But again, all I really did was, in a good sense as an ad man, I had looked for a product that would fill a niche. I had identified customers who, in effect, were telling me, And I tell the story that when I was in the Marines, one of the things that we'd sit around in a squad bay bullshitting about was, you know, sports. And guys would come up, hey, could Bruce Lee beat Muhammad Ali? And guys would argue it and debate it. And that registered with me. I kept thinking to myself, a lot of guys are curious as to whether a boxer or a wrestler would win in a mixed match. When I did homework and found out that it had been around before in history, I said to myself, you know, I'm bringing back the glory of the ancient world. John Milius agreed with me. He said, as author, he said, you are bringing back Excalibur. He said, you're helping these guys pull the sword out of the stone. He said, this Ultimate Fighting Championship is going to create a new fighting icon. If he's who I think he's going to be, he's going to be bigger and better and badder than the World Heavyweight Boxing Champ, because a lot of them boxers ain't going to be able to do too good with them grapplers. And he was right.
Right.
That's what got proved.
Absolutely. And, I mean, it's crazy that, you know, a concept, research, which you did a bunch of.
Yes.
Looked at, I mean, you know everything about every type of mixed martial arts. Whether you're an expert or not yourself,
yeah,
is not the case.
Right.
You have knowledge. Sambo, judo, jiu-jitsu,
yes,
et cetera, et cetera. Then decided to become a student under jiu-jitsu. And,
yep.
And, you know, what a blessing for the Gracies. I mean, for those who know Gracies all across the world, you know, it's because of this man studying under the Gracies and creating a platform and having them in on the first experience to find out who's
absolutely
the baddest man. And
Gracie, absolutely,
you know, Hoist Gracie, who we all look at as like, oh my gosh, the skinny 170-pound dude,
right,
can beat anybody. You know, that's all because of an insight and a focus to make sure that the world had a chance to see. So I like that. On a standpoint of being in you know, an entrepreneur, but also
right,
somebody who's a visionary. But what happened later was it caught the eye of some very important people. When you talk about billionaires, and for those who don't know, billionaire is a very, very rare thing in this world.
Sure.
There's, you know, in America, maybe 470.
Total.
Total. Under 500.
Yep.
Billionaires, period. Across the globe, you know, not the numbers aren't impressive. Those are the elite of the elite. You attracted with your vision, your passion, and what you had put together, you know, two young men and Dana White, who I know very well, and Lorenzo, mm-hmm, and Frank Fertitta, who I know very well,
right,
to want to take a piece of this thing. And at the time, it was bought for
$2 million.
For $2 million.
Right.
$2 million. And along the way, you're making money on this thing.
Yep.
Probably spending some money as well.
Sure.
But creating something that, and especially you're talking about 1993
is
when you started.
94,
95,
yeah.
And it was bought in
2001. Yes.
Right. So you've had 15 fights at this point. You've had 5 years in the game. And now you've attracted some folks that say, hey, we want to buy this from you. We want to take this thing to the next level. And they had a vision. That's Dana White, Lorenzo, Frank Fertitta. And for those who don't know the story, Dana White and Lorenzo Fertitta were high school buddies.
Yes.
Dana was doing boxing, kickboxing classes around Las Vegas, creating some sort of hype for himself as a inventor and a visionary for these corporate kickboxing classes.
Right.
And he convinced, after he was managing a couple fighters, his high school buddy, billionaires,
right,
of the station's casinos,
yep,
to take a leap of faith, buy this thing for $2 million. For my boy here, that's a great pity penny. From zero to $2 million on a purchase, that's a massive home run.
And not only that, you got to give the Fertitta brothers full credit that they then put $50 million into it.
Exactly.
They really put their money where their mouth was, and they took a little bit of a beating the first 2 years. But when they finally got the Ultimate Fighter, 2005, and that second season in 2006 with the Bonnar-Griffin fight, they were really learning. By the way, I was at Mandalay and Sports Entertainment at the time, Peter Guber's company, and I was pitching a show called Fight Quest, which was the Ordinary Joes coached by the pros, and I was there talking to the same people at Craig Borsari at the time over at Spike, just as Lorenzo was. And I give full credit to the Fertittas that they put their money and they invested in this thing and stuck it out and we're able to see this thing finally make a real turnaround. We all knew at the time, I think a lot of us who were smart, that if you had the formula, which Vince McMahon had, of a weekly cable show where you could create your heroes and villains and then bring them over to pay-per-view for the fans to spend money on, that was the formula. That's why I was at Mandalay Entertainment looking to develop a cable show, you know, with a USA Network.
Just real quick, Mandalay Entertainment was Peter Guber's company.
Yes.
And I actually happened to meet Peter Guber, who's an incredible entrepreneur, a producer of producers. He's done probably $1 billion worth of films.
Absolutely.
From The Color Purple to Rain Man to
Flashdance,
etc., like we talked about before. And you're in cahoots with this guy at this point. I had a chance to sit down and talk with this guy, and I mean, he was tight with Muhammad. He was tight with Mike Tyson, any of the who's who of the world, Oprah yes. Winfrey, etc.
He was in business with Magic Johnson on the baseball team. Magic Johnson. Yeah.
Peter Guber is the man, and so it's so crazy to see, you know, the roots of mixed martial arts touch the elbows of the movie industry and back to the business world. You know, myself being a guy who's passionate about the fight game, but also now learning more about the business and wanting to produce movies, etc. See how the whole entertainment circle is happening. And I just think it's really cool to be sitting here. We're in a room at a naval base in Pennsylvania, and I got a chance to talk to this guy. But this is a guy that started out with his vision, which created a future for me, a future for myself, for my team, et cetera, et cetera. And also having these ties with folks that I looked up to, like Milius as a director and Peter Guber as a producer, and the Fertitta brothers and Dana White as businessmen, and it all started with this guy. So this is kind of a monumental conversation with me. We've had a couple beers. We were out, it's late at night right now. I convinced him. He stayed up a little bit late to do this conversation. But we're talking about the next phase of mixed martial arts with the first phase of mixed martial arts. And the coolest part is you've got a book, which has just been the rights have been bought.
It's been optioned as a film, yes.
To be a film, and this is the second time it's been optioned.
Yes,
which I've been learning a lot about the movie industry. So, kind of tell me about that process. What you've learned as a business guy and as a salesman with the movie industry, and your story, and how intriguing it is. But what's happening now with it?
Well, you know, it was interesting. I've been talking to people over the last 10 years about doing a book. Everybody wanted me to do a book about the entire 19 shows that I did on the UFC over that 5-year period, from 1990. 2.5 to 1998. But I really decided that maybe what we really wanted to do, the most important show, the seminal show, the inaugural show, because if that hadn't been successful, there'd be no UFC and maybe there'd be no MMA as we know it.
Right.
So I wound up doing this book starting in 2013. I moved back to Nevada from Beverly Hills. And I sat down over 7 months with my good friend Sean Wheelock as my editor. And I did this book called Is This Legal? Again, based on what Chuck Norris had said to us back in the day when we invited him to come to the party. And we had a great publisher, Ascend Books, that did a lot of celebrity books and sports books. And the book started to do very well. And we got tremendous reviews on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. And 2015, Legacy Entertainment Partners and Paradigm Pictures, Federico Lupenda's company, made me an offer to option the book. They wanted to make an independent movie. So I wound up going with Legacy. And they hired two writers, Tanner Bean and Christy Mathewson, who later wound up working on the great Fox TV show about a female baseball player called Pitch. And they were proteges of Dan Fogelman's, who's also, when you look at his record in IMDb, is a great screenwriter, producer, and director. Eat, Pray, Love, the film Cars for Pixar. And Tanner and Katie came in and took about 10 months, did a script, and then Legacy brought in a gal by the name of Dina Heisel, a great writer, who a script doctor, and she tweaked it and even made it better. And then Legacy attempted over the next year to raise $30 million to produce this as an independent movie. They hired Robert Latham Brown, who Mel Brooks once called Mr. Under Budget, because whenever they were on a movie and Mel started to spend money, Robert Brown would say, Mel, were over budget. And he became Mr. So he was the production manager, and he and I, he taught, teaches film at UCLA. He and I became good friends. But I got lucky due to certain circumstances and actually was able to get the rights back in July of 2017. And then through an agent at Wasserman, LA, my agent, we were able to get four new offers, really good offers, from established producers who have studio connections. And we finally settled on one. I'm actually due to sign the final paperwork on Monday. They've already hired two writers who are just tremendous talents who have done a lot of work already that's been notable. Included, they worked for David E. Kelly on Ally McBeal and a great TV show about high schools back in the early 2000s. They're working already on the script for Is This Legal? And the producer is moving forward to be able to attract the right director and the right actor to the project. But these two writers feel that what the script they're going to create, and they've just written a script which has been optioned by Greg Silverman, former head of film production at Warner Brothers, called Brando, about some tough, dark years in Marlon Brando's history. And everybody's been talking about that script in Hollywood for the last year. So these two writers, Uriah, are real excited about the script. They read the book. Their agent read the book. And right. He ran around their office saying, my God, they actually looked at my old car commercials. As you asked me before about being an entrepreneur, I owned a car dealership in San Diego. I owned a video dating service, a computer software development company. And you know, I've got an extensive background as an entrepreneur, and my home run, of course, has been the UFC. So now with the success of the book, and now the book being optioned, we're looking forward to sometime in 2018 to see this film go in front of the cameras at some point. And quite frankly, with the international market of MMA fans worldwide now, from you know, from Asia, Europe, South America, and North America, that there's going to be a good base of people who would be interested in this movie who are martial arts fans. On the other hand, there's a great soap opera drama in how this thing all came together. You know, the Gracies are a soap, Shakespearean opera all by themselves. Yeah. And, you know, the loves and the betrayals and how this all came together. You know, it was an up-and-down trip for about, you know, a year and a half where we finally got this together and be able to produce that first event, which was so successful. So they're hoping to craft a script and a film that will appeal to the same type of audience that related very well to Moneyball, as an example, a movie about baseball that, you know, unless you were technically oriented and understand what Billy Beane had done with the Athletics, might have been tough to communicate to an audience. But they're very excited about the fact that there'll be a worldwide audience of men and women who will find the drama of what it took to create this show, and now it's become a multi-billion-dollar industry worldwide. So we're hopeful this year, Uriah, that we'll see a good film come out of this.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny because, like I talked to you about privately, is one of my passions is the entertainment industry. I was just in The Rock's movie Rampage, which will be out soon, mm-hmm. if it's not out already, mm-hmm. depending on when this plays. But mm-hmm. I've also got a couple projects that I've been working on, and you just realize how important a great script is and a great story is. And a real story in this is going to be, in my opinion, intriguing to a lot of folks, especially with the growing spirit of mixed martial arts and the UFC in general.
Right.
So I'm excited for this to happen. I'm as excited to see how it pans out. And the movie industry is a lot like the fight game. When I first started in the fight game, it wasn't necessarily like a clear path. Mm. I was 133-pound wrestler. Mm. I had to come in and fight 155 pounds. It was illegal in California until 2005. Right. It was, you know, I'm 2 years
before. You were fighting on Native American
fighting
casino property.
Indian reservations.
Right.
I'm you know, making a couple hundred bucks and fighting guys out of my weight class and had to see this thing through. But in the movie industry, there's a recipe. When you have money behind something, it starts to happen. When you have the right writers behind something, it gains clout. It's like, you know, if I were to beat a Joe Schmo Slum in a fight, no big deal. But if I beat Jens Pulver, who's the first champion of all time, then my clout goes up. And when Jose Aldo beats me for the first time, his clout goes up. It's champion versus champion versus champion.
Right.
In the movie industry, the writers that have done something. The you talked about
the actors.
You talked about the getting the right director attached, yes, and getting the right actor attached.
Right.
That is what brings money to the table, which brings eyes to the table, which brings a real finished product. So this thing's set up to be a success. I'm excited to have been able to meet you, to hang out with you, somebody that has provided a career for me, and also a cool mofo. I'm telling you, we just hung out and drank some beers, and I don't know if you're married or not, but it seemed like these young ladies were already into you. I'm like, that's the gift of gab, baby. I can relate. So thanks, Art, again for being here with me. Spent a little time. That was an hour.
Beautiful.
We just went through. It's good. Late at night. We had a couple beers and we're some kindred spirits. So this is the Cali Cast. You guys, thanks for tuning in. This is Art Davey, a legend in the sport, the creator of UFC, an iconic guy who is doing big things currently, in the past, and in the future. My kind of guy. So thanks again for coming.
My pleasure, Uriah. And again, there's only one California kid.
Here we are. Thanks, guys. Tune in next time.